We continue in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. God, we thank you for this day and this community gathered in your name. Strengthen our consent to be all you created us to be. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleasure to be here and see the beautiful sunshine. And you know, the gift of this part of Florida is you have roses. I love seeing roses. We don't get many roses where I am. So this morning we're going to place the welcoming prayer and just talk a little bit about the human condition. Now, for those of you that are interested and that know Thomas Keating's material, he has spent a lifetime developing this topic. So I know that one of the prayer groups is reading Invitation to Love, which he does this in much more detail. His Spiritual Journey video series also covers it. And pretty much everything he writes or says deals with this material. So this is the little Cliff Notes version for today. We know there's a level of consciousness. We hope there's a level of consciousness. There's the invitation to a level of consciousness, which is aware that we're here. There is the divine indwelling, which is the truth of the incarnation and the mystery of our faith. For me, it's the most underutilized truth that we that call ourselves Christians rely on. The divine indwelling, that there is never a moment or an experience you can have apart from God. It doesn't exist, except in those top 3 inches of this head that we give so much power to. And finally, we know there's a level of unconscious. St. Paul said, "Why is it I don't do what I want to do and I do what I don't want to do?" Have you had that experience in your life? You may have had it this morning already. So that it's not, if it were that easy that with consciousness we simply choose, everyone in this room has already made, you've made your choice. You're not sitting in this chair by accident. You're not here at this stage of your life because your consciousness hasn't said yes. It's the rest of it that we have a little bit of trouble with, right? So in Luke's gospel, let's go to one of Jesus' passages. In the course of his journey, he came to a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. Now, she had a sister named Mary who sat at his feet and listened to him. Martha, who was distracted with all the serving, came to him and said, "Jesus, don't you care that my sister is leaving me to do all the serving? Please tell her to help me." But Jesus said, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and distracted, and it is Mary that has chosen the better part, and it will not be taken from her." So we've all heard that over and over again. Poor Martha. Poor Martha. But going a little deeper, Martha's the one that they said had the house. Okay? Two, she's the one that welcomed him. We just heard in Scripture this past week that when Jesus sent the 12 out 2 by 2, he told them, don't take any provisions. So not only was Jesus and the group coming to Martha's home, they probably hadn't eaten. So the distraction, the serving she was doing was integral and really appreciated because they hadn't eaten. So the food and the serving and the table. So what the invitation has to do with isn't a judgment on what Martha was doing. I think that Mary was the younger sister. And I think there's a lot of stuff there about what Mary and Martha did and didn't do. But whatever it was, the invitation that Jesus was giving was, Martha, I'm right here. I'm right here. The other part that's very startling about this passage was Martha prayed as I was taught to pray. This is what prayer was for me when I grew up. Did she blast Mary? No. Did she even go to everybody else and says, do you see what I'm doing? No, she turned to Jesus. But this is where welcoming and the crux of the matter is. She turned to Jesus and she said, fix her. Did you get that very subtly? How often we do that? Yeah, I'm going to pray for you because I know what's best for you. Let me tell you what you should do. I don't know if you have that in your family of origin. But that's what was going on. So all of a sudden, it shifts. Instead of the gift of the living word is right there, and I get to be in not only proximity, but I get to serve and offer my gifts there. I get into what you're doing, whether you're doing what I want you to be doing, how you should be doing it. And I also think, because I suffer from this, and some of you may relate, that Martha really wanted this to be a special meal. So it wasn't just the work that is entailed, but it had to be a certain way, and the table had to look a certain way, and it had to be hot at a certain time, and everything had to be ready. So there was a lot of complicating factors. But what does Jesus pull Martha back to? I'm right here. You're out there into all of this, and I'm right here. I see you, I love you, I appreciate your work. So Mary didn't have the best part, because the best part is to be able to either be sitting at the feet, which sometimes that's what we got to do over there. You got to close your mouth, sit down, close your eyes, and not worry about anything else. But isn't most of your life spent Martha-ing? Where you can't close your eyes when you're driving, you don't get that option. When you're doing everything else, pretty much, you're asked to be present and active and actively engaged. So the invitation is, how do I do it with that same heart? That's the best part that we're all invited into, to bring that same level of consent and openness into whatever it is we're doing. But what gets in our way? Well, that's what we're going to talk about. That's this level of unconsciousness. Consciously, when they walked in the door, Martha said, welcome. I bet you're hungry. Would you like something to eat? And got to it. So the divine indwelling at that presence was right there. Not only here, but right here. But what takes over? See, the dance of the human condition, which is all our goodness, all our creativity, all your gifts are part of the package. This is a very important part. Sometimes when we're talking about this, we do the human condition and we kind of trash it. It's all that specialness about you that has your fingerprints on it, that has your unique little quirks and quarks. It also has a bunch of crap that's uniquely yours too. So that's where the dance comes in, is how do we celebrate it and not fixate or over-identify with who we think we should be. So as human beings, the one thing about us is we're incredibly adaptable. But we're also slow learners, my opinion. But we're slow developers. We gestate almost as long as the elephants. I think they're about the only one that's longer. But how, those of you that are parents, how long does it take to raise a human being? You know, the birds do a couple batches a year. You know, the butterflies the same way, they drop them. So we take a while because we're a little more complicated in this process. All human beings come with certain developmental needs. And Mary used to teach, really, it starts in the womb. And if you do any of the stuff on the vibrations, what we picked up before we even could process anything. So, but we all come out, and what the welcoming prayer is really addressed at, and what the teachings on the false self are primarily addressed at, are these first three unconscious energy centers, and then the group over-identification that comes with it. We all come out, and instantly, the need for security or survival is there from the get-go, right? Survival, security, that is a fundamental physiological need. It's non-negotiable. Did you need to be fed? We needed a certain temperature. It's non-negotiable. Those things, if they're not there, what happens?
We die.
We don't make it. The other need we have that is pre-programmed, remember, and somehow God did this, and we're in the image and likeness, so it's not right or wrong, good or bad. That's an important part. It's just how it is the need that started as a fundamental need for affection, approval, or esteem. You can use a lot of different words, but I'm going to use affection. Somebody had to love you. Or we literally stop growing. You know, failure to thrive. The hottest area in failure to thrive is now the elderly. You can't warehouse people at the beginning of life or the end of life. We need to be touched and appreciated and loved somehow. Finally, we need a certain level of power or control. What's a 2-year-old's favorite word when they finally master it?
No.
No. Right? And it's not just that they learned the word and it's short and easy to say. It's to begin to impact our environment. These come very chronologically and, you know, they're developmental milestones. One of my former lifetimes, I was a director of a residential facility for pregnant and parenting teenage girls. So some of them had toddlers, and they'd come for their pregnancy. So sometimes you had different age groups. And what would inevitably happen is you can picture 15 or 16-year-olds. They only have so much time for 2-year-olds. So they would leave the 2-year-olds together. And if staff weren't right on top of it, what happens when you leave 2 2-year-olds in the living room with toy? You know what happens. Pretty soon you hear the squeal. And one of them, they used to call me Miss Mary there, and would come and she said, "Miss Mary, this little one has a bad attitude." It takes one to know one, doesn't it? And it would take a lot of time, but to get through to them, that's not a bad attitude. That's what 2-year-olds do. That's the developmental milestone of 2-year-olds. They do not naturally share or play cooperatively. They're not supposed to. We're not supposed to at that age. So that's just the way it is. Now, at some level, you take this from birth to about 3, those 3 things are all operative. By 3, you've kind of been finding a way to get your needs met. From 4 to 7, you add all the cultural conditioning. Your family, your church, your school, your neighborhood, your peer group, all that comes into play. The trouble is, we're raised by other human beings. And no human being gets those needs met to our satisfaction. This is how the human condition and that little false self starts to develop. We all got the need met somehow or some way because you grew out of it physiologically and physically. But many of us got stuck at all these different layers. There's real deprivation. You know, you look at, I can barely watch the refugee crisis in Syria. And the one thing I saw was a family walking and the little, about 18-month-old, everybody had clothes on because it's cold there now where they were walking. But the little kid's feet had no socks on it. That image, I just can't, she was being carried, or he, but the little feet. So there's real deprivation happening to security. I mean, that's the primary one, affection and control. But all of us had perceived deprivation. And some of us had real deprivation. Do you know, the truth of the matter is, and I've heard the story play out and seen it play out in so many ways, if you were one of several children, or if you had several children in close proximity, sometimes one parent is having a baby and the other little one needs you. But guess what? You can't be two places at one time. So the one who you can't be with does experience real deprivation. But you might have taken care of it. Like, I was Aunt Mary, so I could be there and parent could trust me. But you know what? When little kid wakes up and doesn't see mommy or daddy or who they want to see, what do you see? Do you see the tear in those little white knuckles? So that's what we do. Remember, we're adaptable. So we can't deal with it, and you can't reason. She'll be home very shortly, don't worry. You know, that doesn't work, right? What we did was we internalized it, and we found ways to cope with it because we're such adaptable little critters. So we keep going, and we develop these patterns of behavior that allow us to mitigate that pain that we can't really handle at that stage. And we keep going. And we develop certain personality patterns and all these different patterns of being. Well, you come to the age of reason, which they say is somewhere around 15, but if you've worked with 15-year-olds, that's hard to know. But your mind, because at this stage, you do have the capacity for bigger thinking and abstract thoughts. But what do we tend to do as we find that? We tend to find a peer group that supports our way of being. Did you notice that? How your kids all of a sudden, no matter where this was, it's the peer group. You just pray they find the right peer group. Because it's that that's going to take them to their next journeys. Because we rationalize, justify, and glorify our behavior. We spend all of that wonderful psychic energy now proving that we're okay. You know, in the old days, many of you will remember there was a book, I'm Okay, You're Okay. Yeah. You know, the great Jesuit teacher, Tony DeMello, his book, uh-huh. I'm an ass, you're an ass, and that's okay. Because he said that it was just everybody else was trying to prove you're okay, when the truth of the matter is it's okay not to be okay. And that's where the healing comes in. So, we have the spiritual awakening, and at a conscious level, we say yes. You've said yes. Yes to the values of the gospel. Yes to be transformed. Yes to the Beatitudes. Yes. Here I am, Lord. Is it me? I say yes. But what we're all carrying around is this wonderful unconscious that's been with us from the beginning. And where is the warehouse? Where is it stored? In the body. This is the most exciting piece of science today. You know, they still haven't fully understood our central nervous systems and how our brains work. And how, if you've had any deep body work done, like, they're finding that it's stored in our body. There's wonderful stuff on just all of the connections, and I find that fascinating. And that's why I love to sit in places like airports where you can anonymously look at people. You watch their story go with them, don't you? After a while, our bodies begin to carry it. In our faces, in our lines, in our pot, everything begins to. I was sharing with a younger friend of mine recently that the gift of aging is you lose the override. Do you know when you're younger, the override? Like everything in you is saying, stop, rest, do this or something. And you have an override that can just go, heck with you. Well, the gift of getting older is, can you do that much anymore? No, I fall flat on my face. My override is losing, I'm not saying it's not there, but it's losing its grip. And guess who's talking more? The body. So the gift of welcoming is it gives me a tool to begin to kind of enter the dance with that I was not given any skills to deal with. I was not told how to dealt with the body or the feelings in the body as they manifest. Now, here comes a practice, this wonderful little prayer, centering prayer, right? Oh, I love centering prayer because we intentionally are sitting down and being quiet and saying, here I am. Do with me what you will. That's what you're basically saying when you sit in the chair. These 20 minutes or 30 minutes, okay, I'm really, really going to trust that you're there and present and active. So I'm saying, basically, bring it on. Here I am. I'm yours. I'm putting down. Because, as Thomas Keating teaches, what's our greatest defense mechanism against God?
Not letting him in.
No, but how do we not let God in? We think about God. Okay, wait. Let me shut you out. I'm going to think about you. So I don't have to deal with your absence because you're very present to me. But not you. I'm going to think about you. I'm going to think what you should do, how you should be, what I think of, you know, happy thoughts. But that thinking about versus the reality of the person. Do you know when you've been like apart from somebody and then you come back and all of a sudden the reality of the person is there? It's like jolting. Like, who are you? How are you? Not how I think you should be, but how are you? It's an openness to an unknowing. The cloud of unknowing. It's coming into a living relationship and putting down the need to define it. So in centering prayer, we consciously... And this is at the level that we use the sacred word or your sacred symbol, whatever it may be, the glance or the breath. But when we are aware we're engaged with thoughts, it's not mantric that it's all the time. It's how do you become aware? It's when you're conscious. I might have packed and unpacked and done the laundries and done it's the grocery list. If I'm having people over for dinner, the hardest thought process is the... What are we going to eat? You know what I mean? That's what will come in over and over and over again. So when I'm aware that I've been to the grocery store and changed the menu 3 times, when I'm aware, I ever so gently return to the sacred word. So what am I really doing? Consciously, I'm coming and I'm saying yes to the divine indwelling. What's the work of the divine indwelling in this whole process? To remove all the obstacles that preclude the free flow of grace. All those emotional programs for happiness that we have embedded in ourselves and spent most of our lives justifying, rationalizing, and glorifying. And they've failed miserably. Thank God. So, guess what? Well, we're inviting, probably not, but we're inviting the divine indwelling We're inviting the invitation to get into our emotional programs that we have spent most of our lives rationalizing, justifying, and glorifying, and that have failed miserably. Because under the guise of these, you're not going to win. You have 7 other billion people on the planet going at that unconscious level. It's a no-win situation. It's like the lottery. I was going to be the cutest little billionaire you ever saw. And that's what I thought. You know, I thought, I'm going to be adorable. I'm just going to be an adorable billionaire. But guess what? How many other million people bought their ticket and I'm not an adorable billionaire today? So it was just that whole piece of, if you go at it from our construct, it's pretty much a no-win situation. That's the gift of aging. You find out it doesn't work. When you're younger, you know, there's a whole bit. Richard Rohr said, you need to have these programs and you need a certain level of success with them up to about 25 or 30 to kind of be put together. But he said, honestly, after about 30, have you learned anything from success or has it been your failures? See, the truth of the matter is, I learn when it doesn't work, because when it does work, I don't know what worked. Do you know what I mean? And I have the tendency to think it was me. When it fails, that's when we're open to what happened. And that's when God can usually get to us. So, we're inviting. In centering prayer, we don't tell you this on the introductory, so anybody who was here on the introductory, sorry, that you're inviting spirit to come down and mess with you. And how are we healed? We're healed the same way Thomas says it's this way. If you have a meal that doesn't sit well on your belly, you get nauseated at some point and you throw up. He said most of us have undigested emotional belly experiences on our psychic belly that have been there 30 and 40 years. When they come up, it's not real pleasant. But what's the quickest way is to let them out. When do you feel better? Right after you throw up. You know, a little kid, I feel sick, I feel sick, I feel sick, and then they... And then what do? They generally run off. You know, they're done. So this practice is about helping us with that process, so it doesn't have to be very complicated. The body and the psyche and the spirit claim the healing. This is just another way to cooperate with the healing. Because remember, under the false self system, I only have two choices, basically. I either repress it, which for me, food was a big repression. Just like, okay, just stuff it down. Just keep something in the mouth so you just stuff it down so you don't feel, except fat. So you just keep stuffing. Or so we either stuff it or we inappropriately express it. Has anybody ever dumped on you? You know, we find the safety places because the valve, it's energy. All this is really about is energy in motion. And so what we're doing is we need a place to put the energy. And I either keep it down in the body, which is why our bodies are holding so much stuff, or we dump it. This is a path that gives me another alternative. Because I didn't know what else to do with it. That's not bad. It's just it's the only options I had. So along comes welcoming and is giving me another opportunity to go through it. So what begins to happen is on a conscious level, our programming goes off. Now, we're taught that Jesus Christ, every experience we have as a human being that he experienced, that he was fully human in that reality. And that's where, if you look at the temptations in the desert, you'll see how, as far as that security and affection and control. So you go out to the desert and you don't eat for 40 days. See, my primary symbol for security, because that's how the false self looks. It looks for symbols to represent that to you. My primary for security was food. Like if I was happy, food. If I was sad, food. If I didn't know, food. But everything was about food. So go out there, don't eat for 40 days. And what's the first temptation?
To eat.
To turn the rock into bread. Now, what's Jesus' response to that? Meaning, not that we don't need physical food, but there is not enough symbols of security, Mary, in the world that will make take away your need for security. It is only found in God. True security is only found in God. You know, the stock market just had a blip, so if you were looking at your portfolio, oh my God. You know that there is not enough, whatever the symbols in our cultural conditioning, because in different cultures and different people will have different images about what it should look like. But the teaching is, it is not out there. There is not enough out there that'll ever take care of that need. Okay, so finally, if you want a little affection, approval, or esteem, go up to the top of the temple or to the top of the church, the highest point you can find in the villages, jump off and let the angels catch you on your way down. Do it at high noon so everybody sees that you are a child of God. That was the second temptation, basically, you know. And what did Jesus say to that temptation? I am loved. I don't need to prove to you. He claimed the love of God. He claimed the affection and the approval in his very being. You are a child of God, and your reason for being is the fact that you are being. So nobody else can love you like God. Henry Nouwen put it this way: human beings are built with a need for first-tier love. The trouble is, human beings are second-tier lovers. So if you're seeking from this plane of existence that hole to be filled that needs first-tier love, it'll constantly be frustrated. Don't you know people? No matter how many partners, children, grandchildren, it's never enough. Because it's not meant to be enough. What happens is, if you connect with your source, you become a better second-tier lover and you expect less coming back to you. You know when somebody has looked at you and expected you to be the answer? And you know that you're going to disappoint, because no matter how hard you even want to be the answer, you're not. Because human beings weren't ever meant to be the answer. So connect with the source and allow yourself to enjoy all the second-tier love you can handle. Finally, if you want a little power or control, bow down before me and I'll give you the whole villages, all of it. You know, your own kingdom or queendom or whatever you want, it's yours. What did Jesus say to that? Doesn't exist. It's God that is the true source of power and control in my life. But it's God's control, not mine. It's the mystery of powerlessness. But there is no sense of, and I don't want to get into politics, but if you really want to look at the beauty of it, we have some of our politicians that are like this: if I can own all of this, it's me. It isn't any of us. Because it's not outside power and control we're talking about. It's that sense of being fully alive in your own body. Like the teachings in all the traditions, there is nothing so strong as weakness. That's what Paul kept saying. That's the mystery of it. And there is nothing as weak as false strength. There is nothing as gentle as true power, because it's contained. So in this practice, we are invited to look at ourselves. Martha, Martha, put your name there. You're worried and distracted about many things. But one thing is important. So that's what we're coming back to. In this process, we just start to see. That's what begins to change. In some of the things I shared last night, for those of you that remember, the Lenten practice of take and accept yourself exactly as you are, where you are, comes from the perspective of all that's happening is God is letting you see this. But you don't have to be terrified of it, because it's God's work in you. So we're not adding that extra layer of fighting it or that energy to fix it as much as to surrender to it and surrender it over. Let go. Mary used to teach, this practice always says, and you'll see the wording is let go. She said, because we as Americans can't stand the word surrender. It really is surrender, but we don't like that. That just gets our back up, you know, surrender. Now, I'm not a loser. And in 12-step circles, I loved this. One of the guys said, I had to really work with that, because he had a very difficult time when everything was powerlessness or surrender. And he said, I finally realized that when you surrender, you join the winning side. So that's how he joins the winning side. He won't say he surrendered. He joined the winning side. So this is the dance that welcoming is at the service of. And I just want to tell you one little story, and then we'll have a break. But first, I'll start with a passage from Thomas's little day book, but I love this one. Surrender to the unknown marks the great transitions on the spiritual journey. On the brink of each new breakthrough, there is a crisis of trust and love. So I might joke about it a lot, but this is very courageous work. And that's why last night we talked about going through all the stages, that it finally rests in trusting enough. Because it's terrifying. What you're letting go of is that piece of yourself that you've told yourself you were and had to be to keep the world running forever. So what we're asked to really let go of is who we thought we were. Thank God that's really not the truth of you. But to be willing to walk into the arms of love and discover who we are. I loved Gus's reading this morning. That was quite beautiful, that we're really just going where we've always been. And that's what it's kind of a waking up to. Thomas says some of the best practice for dying is centering prayer, because you're asked to let go of everything. So you get practice in letting go, inch by inch, to really prepare us for the final. But if we believe the truth, we're not going anywhere but back to the source from which we emanate from the beginning. So this little body that we've been asked to kind of be with during this time, that's going to be the invitation to get a little closer to it. So a story of how this kind of played out a little bit in some of my life. I'm the youngest of five. That's what they started with. But the truth is, I'm a surprise after four. And they are all much older than I am, as I tell them. So the oldest was 18, the youngest was 8, and I came along. And my parents always laughed, and the birth story was how much, if you knew me, I'm a good sleeper. What it really means is, one, I am a good sleeper usually, but two, I need a lot of sleep. But I was a bit premature. And my mother always told the story that I slept through my first feeding. And the doctor said, don't be concerned, because she needs sleep more than she needs food. Now, if you knew me, two things that are really up there are food and sleep. So that the doctor picked one over the other is a questionable fact. So long story short, as life evolved, food was always my comfort, but my nemesis. It's always been my primary dance. And when I was a little girl and everybody else would be thinking about their weddings or that whole thing, I would always be stuck with, could I eat the wedding cake or not? I mean, literally, that was the big thing, like, or would I not, or just, anyway. So I always thought you'd grow out of it, because hopefully kids do grow out of their things, but my pieces just kept intertwining through my personality. So the right school. Okay, well, I did. I went to a great university, and I had a wonderful education, and I kept thinking I would grow out of it, like grow out of myself. But when I got to college in the late 70s, it was just a hotbed of eating disorders and everything else. So I just found a whole peer group that totally understood my craziness. So then it would be, well, when you got the right job. So, you know, I got the job and I got the boyfriend and everything. It would be like, well, it'll be okay when. So I went through all of that, but after about 6 months, wherever I was, the food would come back into it, out of control food. So I was finding out that all my answers weren't working. So the best thing you can do then is pray, right? Okay, so then I really got into centering prayer. I was into this, and I was into my late 20s. And my dear friend, Sister Rita, at the House of Prayer in Erie, I had been through the Ignatian exercises and done all of that, and we were really into centering prayer. We had a centering prayer group. And she goes out to Colorado, to Thomas Keating, to the 10-day intensive, and comes back and says, Mary, this is the retreat for you. And she got shingles, and she said it was part of the unloading. Well, she was a 60-year-old nun, and I was like a 29-year-old woman, and I said, if you got shingles, I'd die. I'm not going. That was literally how I was, you know what? So a dear friend of mine in the prayer group, because she every time would say, this is the retreat for you, honey. Because I loved the prayer, and we were watching the videos. I was totally engaged in the teaching, but I was scared to death. So a friend of mine, he was about my age, a little older, but he was an ophthalmologist. He signed up to go on retreat, so I signed up to go on retreat 2 months after him. Because he was my canary in the well. If he went and did not die, I would go. And literally, that was very much how I looked at it, you know, just. Now, he did have a huge breakthrough and was in therapy for years, but I did not know that. Thank God I did not know that. So I go on retreat, finally, and it was. It was just totally life-changing. It was like I thought what Thomas Keating gave in my life was he described the spiritual journey in terms I could understand. He talked about the psychology that I knew about and sociology and our tradition. So he merged the gap, because before it was one or the other. Like it was this or here, but I didn't know how they tied together. And I never heard anybody talk about John of the Cross or Teresa of Avila and speak in contemporary terms that understood my life. But here he was speaking it. And I thought, and when I sat there, I knew that if I heard no other teaching than those spiritual journey tapes for, I was 30 years old, for the next 30 or 40 years, that I had my work cut out for me just to live into what I had heard. But they also had the best food I ever had in my whole life. They were vegetarian. They made all their own food. Pat Johnson and Marianne Matheson in the heyday, they made bread at the time. I was just in little hog heaven. And they sold their their recipes. So I came back more committed than ever to the prayer, but with the recipe book. So I was going to eat that food and do the prayer. I was a banker at the time. So anyways, I'm eating the food, doing the prayer, and I think, well, this is it. So where do I, that's what I told you last night. Where do I go from here? Thomas gives me two names, Mary Mrzowski or that. The next weekend, I fly up to Chrysalis house. They had pretty much the same food as they did in Snowmass. And Mary was Italian. She was a great cook. So I signed up and left, you know, did a little discernment. Okay, a few months went by. But I ended up living there. Gave up the house, gave up the car. Everything had just been, I was free to use singleness to really to my advantage and be there. Well, guess what? At some point, the food came back. Because who ends up in charge of the shopping and the buying for the retreat center? And who finds herself into the cookie jar or whatever the proverbial thing would be? And I was like, I was totally with God. Here I am. Okay, I don't know what else to do. I have no job. I have no worldly belongings. I live at a retreat center. I am sitting 3+ hours a day. I am, you know, I'm out of options, and I am totally under by addiction food. It was totally out of control. Well, of course, as God did in my life, we had soul friending. So each of the weekends, we would be assigned to people I had to talk to. So somebody got me. But she had shared in the big group that she was at that weekend to strengthen her 11-step practice, which if you know the steps, it sought through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. So she was a very attractive, and she was younger. Most people were older at this time, because I'm in my early 30s now, and she was younger. And so I thought cocaine, you know. She looked, must be cocaine. So she was in my soul friending, and it turns out it was food. She started to share about her stuff, and I started to just sit there and cry, like God just sent you right to me. So anyways, I got into that was my real introduction. I'd been to Al-Anon and adult children and all of that beforehand, but this was my real bottom with that piece of it. Anyway, so as I'm doing my work, and you go back through and you do it, I remembered that birth story. So I called my mother up, and I said, is it true? Because you know how family tales get going. And she said, oh, yeah, no, you slept through your first. We tried to, you know, do this to the bottom of your feet, but we couldn't wake you. So, and I said, did I room in with you? She said, oh, no, I was born in 1958. You didn't room in. And then she said, you were put on a schedule. Well, what I knew intuitively, this is just for me, and it was just God giving me, you don't always know, but this made sense to this little being. I did sleep through my first feeding. I did not sleep till my second feeding. Because the energy behind my food addiction is such that it is way beyond, I mean, rationally I know I will not die if I don't eat that, but energetically you would think I would die if I don't eat that. It's that kind of energy behind it. So whatever this was that was programmed in me, and I'm Irish. I have a friend that says they're part of the CIA. They're Catholic, Irish Catholic, and alcoholic. But Irish Catholic is enough to program you for addiction on any level, on anything. So I fully qualified genetically to be programmed. But that piece just really fit on how it played out. I could just see how it played out through the whole thing. And I kept addressing prayer to fix it. And what I was with is God kept inviting me, instead of fixing it, to let go of it. You know the difference? It's a really big difference. And this is what Thomas is saying in his latest, one of his latest writings, because somebody said last night, we have to fix ourselves, which is true. But, you know, you wouldn't be here if you didn't want to be the better you. But listen to what he says. Powerlessness is our greatest treasure. Don't try to get rid of it. Everything in us wants to get rid of it. Grace is sufficient for you, but not something you can understand. What this prayer and what all of these practices for me do is they bring me to the point where I finally say, wow, God, I do really need you. I can't do this. And instead of that being failure, which is just a word, you want to use it, fine, but you don't have to. What I call it is truth. It's the truth of what we're invited to be, that we're standing in God's grace, and we constantly then begin to turn over and say, what would you have me do with this? The false self is telling us all the time what should be done, who should do it, and how it should look. And it's very hard to get the voice, these voices down, but what we're listening and what we're beginning to tune our ears to through centering prayer and now through the welcoming prayer, which we'll get, is what is this telling me? What would you have me do? So, after our break, we're going to come back and we're going to have the little practice. That's what welcoming is totally at the behest of. So it is 10:35. So we'll have a 15-minute break and come back and talk about the welcoming practice itself. Okay?